I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. The expression, physician, heal thyself, is so old that even when Jesus used it, he was passing along a phrase everybody around him already knew. Today, we're going to hear from somebody who knows just how baffling the experience can be for a newly trained medical professional, fresh out of training, to start working as a physician in earnest. Can anybody really feel up to it? You know, all the official qualifications are in. A critical mass of expertise has been certified. It's official. But even at that, a brand new doctor might have more than just a few misgivings, a little bit of self-doubt. Adam Stern is a psychiatrist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's also an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. His writings about practicing medicine have been published widely, and now he has a memoir out. It's titled Committed, Dispatches from a Psychiatrist in Training. Adam Stern, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to talk with you.
I want to know right off the bat if there's any patient you know of who really wants to hear that caretakers might have imposter syndrome. I mean, that's a little disconcerting, wouldn't you think?
That is an interesting question, an interesting perspective, because you're right. There's a bit of a duality, right? Because we want our physicians, our caretakers, our medical doctors, and everybody that we touch through the medical system, we want them to be professional and competent, but at the same time, we want them to be human beings, right? And part of being a human being is the struggle of being imperfect. And so I hear what you're saying, that there's the idea that imposter syndrome is rampant really throughout the medical community, especially in the early goings of training, might set someone back a little bit and say, hey, what does that mean? And maybe if I can take a moment just to define what I'm talking about for your listeners. I think of imposter syndrome not as a state where you are not competent, not as a state where you are not doing the job you need to do, but rather it feels like you're not where you need to be. Rather, maybe you've achieved a lot, but you haven't yet started feeling like you belong. And I experienced this certainly 10 years ago when I first started out in psychiatric training after medical school, and I found that a lot of different of my classmates, my colleagues, not just in psychiatry but across the board in medicine, were experiencing the same thing. And I think part of it is because they look around and, you know, you only really have access to your own inner world. But when you look around, it looks like everybody's doing just fine, when in fact on the inside they're probably experiencing something very similar.
So if you're somebody, though, who has been trained to try to understand the human psyche, and you probably knew that it would be unnerving going into this, that you might have something like imposter syndrome, did that put you in a better position to cope with it when it came?
That's an interesting question, because I think you're right that medical professionals, as they go through training, you know, there's been a lot talked about and written about the long road to medicine. You know, so the undergraduate training that leads you into the medical training that leads you into finally your residency training, and then sometimes fellowship beyond that, before you're a full-fledged whatever you might be, in my case, psychiatrist. So there's a lot of practice. You know, you end up becoming very comfortable with being uncomfortable in new scenarios, studying and being tested in scenarios that you'd never been in before, adapting to new environments and new stressors. These things, as a medical trainee, you learn to do because you've been through it so many different times before. And yet, every time it's a little bit different.
Does the analysis that you just did right there for us, to be comfortable with feeling uncomfortable, I'm just wondering if at some point that's kind of, you know, an onion with lots of layers, where you can say to yourself, I'm going to be comfortable with being uncomfortable, but then the discomfort comes. I mean, what I'm saying is it's an oxymoron.
Yeah, I hear it. I hear what you're saying. And what I'm going to do is flip it around a little bit and just talk about what we talk about with our patients a lot, which is that when our emotions come, we can control a lot of things, but we can't always control our emotions. And so one of the techniques that a lot of patients will actually end up subscribing to and finding useful is to allow acknowledging their emotions when they see them, noticing them, which is the first step, and then actually allowing that emotion the space to exist. And often if it's something like anxiety, fear, worry, these things will be worst when you start noticing them. And then if you just do nothing at all over time, they'll tend to dissipate. And so I hear what you're saying, but at the same time, one of the skills, one of the techniques that psychiatrists practice, but also probably become comfortable with themselves and proficient themselves, is the idea of existing in a space that is uncomfortable.
Well, I want to use a word that may not be clinically, orthodox here. Decompression. So here you are, you're a resident, you're a brand new resident, you're actually practicing, and it's tough, and you're encountering stuff that on your own, you're going solo in many instances. And then I'm just wondering if the pace, we hear about the experience of resident, the pace is so frenetic sometimes. You don't have time to de-stress. You don't have time for those emotions just to kind of be.
You're absolutely right about that. The pace of residency, and this remains a major issue across medical training to this day, the pace and the intensity, the number of hours that they work has been tweaked and sort of adjusted and limited in various ways. But the intensity and the responsibility that comes with the job is very intense. And so something that I thought was important was to acknowledge that a lot of residents end up seeking help or seeking a space for themselves in a therapy of their own. That's something that's, frankly, sort of, if not encouraged, at least not discouraged in psychiatry. A lot of other fields, there's a lot more stigma to it. So it is so important, if not in a formal therapy, for residents, trainees, young academics, to have time to themselves to decompress, to use your word. It's so important. It's essential. The more that people put that off, it's like a little bit like doing the house cleaning. If you clean the house once a week, each time you do it is just a little bit painful. But if you wait for a month to do it, it's going to be really bad. And so self-care is one of those things where you got to do it a little bit all the time.
So this is a memoir that you've written, and so you're going to be autobiographical, and this is where the rubber hits the road for me. Tell me your story of when you first felt, dare I say, overwhelmed.
Oh, my goodness. I felt overwhelmed almost immediately. And the reason is that one day you are a student, an MD student, you graduate, and then the next day when you start the residency, you are the doctor. Someone refers to you as doctor, in my case, Dr. Stern. And my very first patient, the very first doctorly thing that I had to do was a neurologic examination to determine if a patient was deceased or not. It sounds like an easy thing to do, but actually it's quite a technical task, and you have to know how to do it right. And so immediately in that moment, it was like being thrown in. It felt very much like being thrown into the deep end, so to speak. That happened over and over and over again in different settings, in different clinical rotations, with different mentors, with different patients. And, I don't think I really started feeling comfortable till later in my residency, in years 3 and 4, where I found my footing a bit. And that was the result of several different factors. One just being the experience of, having good teachers, having lots of different patients that I've worked with. And, again, that becoming a little bit desensitized to the novelty of and the discomfort of being in an unusual and a new setting, a new environment, and with new responsibilities.
So I want you to paint a picture for me of exactly what happened in that room when you were supposed to ascertain if somebody was deceased. Did you have an impulse to look over your shoulder or to go flag somebody down and say, can you walk me through this? Or were you really left to go solo on your own?
Yeah, so the answer to your question is across a couple different – I have to answer it in one or two ways, because the truth is that I was sent in there on my own. However, I knew later on I would be presenting my results to a more senior person, an attending physician that would probably be double-checking the work that I had done, if there was any question whatsoever. But, you know, so there is that. There is a big safety net around medical training, where the more senior people are available very often, but very often also responsible at the end of the day for what happens. And so if they're taking their job seriously, which they very generally are, they will be backing you up in real time, or at least soon after. But in the painting the picture for you, you know, okay, go see this patient, and you need to determine if death has occurred. You know, before I walked into the room, I was literally on one of these medical subscription services, which is called UpToDate, and it's an UpToDate subscription service that tells you, you can type in, you know, determination of brain death, for example, and it'll come up with the steps that a physician has to take to check this, and there are various criteria that have to be met in order for that to occur, and so it's unbelievable how much that happens early in medical training, that folks are learning on the job as they're being supervised properly, but also, you know, trying to figure it out on their own. And then I went in, and this completely unconscious woman who was very much alive was not able to respond to me in any kind of meaningful way, but I introduced myself for the very first time as Dr. Stern. And when I tested various reflexes, they were there, and there were various signs that, in fact, brain death had not occurred. And it was a wonderful experience for me to have it be my very first patient experience as a physician, because it showed me that as intense and challenging and overwhelming an experience as you can imagine it might be, it still can leave you feeling like you did the job and you can do it. You can, if you just keep taking the next right step and you keep trying to prepare and you access your supervision when you need it, you can make it happen.
So the question was, is this person alive or are they brain dead? And I'm just wondering, even knowing, as you did, that there was some backup there ultimately, that somebody would be supervising or checking up on your findings, you must have felt like the stakes were high. And
incredibly.
I'm wondering,
life or death, really. I mean, literally life or death is all around you when you're a medical trainee. So one of the things that came across to me, it was taught by one of my supervisors named Tom Gutile years ago. But I don't know if it stems from him or if it's even beyond that. But it was a phrase called never worry alone. So if I wasn't convinced at the end of that evaluation in one direction or another, I would have been, you know, looping in my senior resident, who would have then had the same opportunity to loop in the attending physician. So it's a stance you've got to take as an early trainee. If you're worried, you shouldn't worry alone. You should worry with someone else, because very often they've seen the road out and they can lead you down it.
Is that a universal axiom? Never worry alone?
It's one that's been passed down from generation to generation in my training program. I don't know. It was the first time I'd ever heard it. And when I Googled it in preparation for the book, I asked myself that same question, and I Googled the phrase, and it's all over the internet. So I don't know if it stems from our program or if it stems from, you know, something much deeper, longer, or, you know, generations gone by.
But you know a lot about mental health because you're a psychiatrist, and I'm wondering if you have turned this into sort of like a philosophy that can be generally and universally applied even apart from your profession. I'm just talking about people like me.
Absolutely. I'm sorry. I agree with you 100%. At a personal level, you can apply this to your life. Absolutely. If, you know, worry, rumination, anxiety, these things have a weight. They have a metaphorical weight that you carry around with you. And in sharing the experience, now you don't want to burden people around you. A lot of us don't. We try our hardest not to burden our loved ones with our problems, our friends, our colleagues, etc. But at the same time, you need to know who and what scenarios you can actually utilize to share the weights of the world, you know, and so that you're not carrying them all by yourself.
So the weight that you carried as a resident, just newly, you know, minted, there you are, permitted to do this, you ended up sharing it, the weight, with other people. And it turned out to be not always superiors either. It was your colleagues who were in the same boat. Tell us about the group that you entered into and the what is it, collegiality, camaraderie, friendship?
Right. Right. It's an intense experience because we were a group of 15. This was back in the Harvard Longwood program. And I was coming from a state university of New York school in Syracuse, New York, which was a wonderful place to study medicine. But it was very different than the environment, the sort of a lot of the sort of attitudes were very different than I found at Harvard. And a lot of my classmates were coming from Harvards and Yales and, you know, really sort of old-timey, prestigious kinds of East Coast institutions that I felt at the time was overwhelming, you know, was in a league that felt by reputation to be different than where I was coming from. What I found over time was that most of my classmates were, A, experiencing the very same doubts and self-doubt and worry and, you know, imposter syndrome that I was feeling, and B, that, you know, what matters most isn't the name of the institution that's on the, you know, on your diploma. It's the education that you got, and it's how you, what you do with it, right? It's how you approach it, how you take it into the world. So my classmates were these 14 really wonderful people, caring. Psychiatry, I think, tends to self-select to some degree for people who have high degrees of empathy. They want to connect. They want to know people's stories and what's important to them. And that was true of the vast majority of the people in my class. So we became very, very close, and we relied on each other. You know, when you are a resident, you're working with patients during the day, and then you hand off the care for those patients to another resident overnight, and they hand it back over to you the next morning, and on it goes like that, you know, for 4 years practically. And so you end up needing to trust each other, and you end up having this very intense mutual respect, camaraderie, all of that. I consider these people lifelong, if not friends, they're almost like siblings or family members.
Well, this would be just a wonderful story were it not for the fact you also describe this group of people as being somehow disadvantaged by the nature of their training and the fact that, I don't know how to say this. It's kind of like they go into a time warp and they get pulled out of society and they're just not normal people.
I think that's a great way to put it. I sometimes will refer to, at least I'll refer to myself in this time of my life as being developmentally stunted, because you've been in school your whole life. You know, you've been, I used to view my life in 4-year increments in terms of high school was 4 years, and then college was 4 years, and then med school was 4 years, and then residency was 4 years. And I did each of those in a different city with meeting new friends and meeting new people and getting interested in different things. And then you move on to the next thing. And it was med school in particular is usually during in the early to mid-20s and of a person's life. That's a very that's a point in time when a lot of people are sort of between adolescence and adulthood, right? A lot of people are – there was an intense mix of rigorous academic study and rigorous non-academic recreation, you know, during medical school. There would be these, like, 3-week blocks of study, take the exams, and then spend the weekend, you know, letting loose a little bit. And then comes residency, and you're an adult, and it's the first time for me, it was the first time I'd ever had a full-time job. And that was true for a lot of my classmates. So, and you're stuck in the hospital together, all together, for hours and hours and hours throughout the weeks, and you end up almost being like, I don't even quite know how to describe it, except that you're, like you said, in a bit of a time warp. You're in your mid to late 20s now, but you're sort of like not doing what your peers are doing out in the world if they didn't follow this medical path.
Have you gotten any kind of feedback from people in that peer group of yours, these professionals, saying, oh, come on, Adam, developmentally stunted, that's a little too far?
I think hopefully they know I mean it with good heart, you know, that I'm one of us, and I feel it's a bit tongue in cheek, because while I feel like we were a little developmentally stunted, I also feel like these people were brilliant, high achieving. They're some of the smartest, most caring people I've ever met in my life. So there's a trade-off, and I think the positives of this group in particular was just so far beyond anything in terms of developmental stunting.
Adam Stern's book is titled Committed: Dispatches from a Psychiatrist in Training. We're going to come back and chat with him right off the bat about that title, Committed. There's got to be a play on words going on there, at least a double meaning. Adam Stern will be with us again in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. This is Constant Wonder. It's a great pleasure to have Adam Stern with us. He's author of Committed: Dispatches from a Psychiatrist in Training. He is a psychiatrist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Okay, the title, Committed, that has to do presumably at least with two meanings. That has to do with patients, but it also has to do with your level of commitment.
You got it. You've got it right. You hit the nail right on the head. You wouldn't believe it, but it took us, me and the editors and the folks at the publishing house, ages to land on a title, because we wanted it to convey the broad topic of psychiatry and mental health. We wanted it to convey to the reader that this sort of dedication to the field, you know, and what it takes to get through. And then there's also the third element of the will they or won't they romance that some people find to be an integral part of the book, and some people say, hey, I wish it was just about the patients and the training, and why did you have to have that love story in there? But, you know, that it's like you said, it's a memoir, and so this is my story, and I did meet my wife in the training program, and there was a lot of will they or won't they, or will we or won't we end up together in those 4 years. So the title, Committed, I feel it did capture several of those sort of criteria in one single word, which is an impressive thing. We struggled with long titles and titles that really long and elaborate subtitles, and you know, finally we landed on Committed: Dispatches from a Psychiatrist in Training. I feel it also conveys maybe to the reader, if they read the book anyway, that one of the things I really struggled with throughout my training, and still to this day, frankly, is if I have to involuntarily treat a patient, meaning treating a patient who doesn't want to be treated, or taking away their freedom because they seem to be a danger, an acute danger to themselves or someone else. This is the lay term for that is commitment. And that is something I've never grown comfortable with. It's always something it pains me to have to do it, but it's part of the job. And so that dilemma, that, you know, coming to terms with that part of the job also was something I was hoping might come across in the title as you read the book.
Well, I would feel more than just weird. I would feel so out of place having to, you know, I mean, those are high stakes too when it comes to freedom. Not as with the brain death scenario you were talking about earlier, high stakes. I'm wondering if there's a way to talk about interventions that you undertake where it's not so cut and dried as to why you're even doing it. I want to believe that it's all science, science, science all the time, but there's a bit of an art here too. And I think a case study might be electroconvulsive therapy, the idea that there's this intervention that can be done even absent a full understanding of why it might work.
Right. There's so much in psychiatry, but also in medicine at large, about this phenomenon that most people would assume starts from the ground up, that you understand the basic fundamentals of the chemistry involved. You build molecules that you think will have an effect on the biology of the person. You test those drugs in people, in animals first and then people, and then you approve a medication and it's perfect, right? But in fact, in medicine, the history of medicine, if you look at it, all the way back to penicillin, for example, it's almost always that we observe a phenomenon, right? So in this case, that the penicillin was not allowing those bacteria to grow. Then you try to take a step back and come up with a hypothesis about why this might help versus something else, or why this has this effect. And then you can design, then you can start building from the ground up and design good clinical trials to try to get things out into the world. ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, which you referenced, is a bit like that. It's been used for decades and decades. Thankfully, we've come a long way in making the treatment humane. It's under anesthesia. One of the chapters in the book, I really describe in great detail what it's like to observe ECT or to even to undergo ECT and from the view of the patient. And ideally, what I want to come across is that this is not what you've seen in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which, you know, psychiatry has the scars of its past quite honestly. It's come by them honestly. Psychiatry decades ago was a field that definitely had missteps. Thankfully, in the modern era, things are very different. And so it's a very humane procedure. And it's still, even though we have lots of ideas about why it might potentially work, you're right that we don't know exactly why it works, but we do know that it works for the vast majority of people with severe depression, with severe acute suicidality, with mood disorders that are so severe that they have psychosis involved. These are areas where electroconvulsive therapy might still be very much useful for patients.
Now, the reason I bring it up is not because of Cuckoo's Nest. It's not because of kind of an interest I have in what the technique. It has to do with it's an example of just what you were talking about. I find this so interesting that sometimes you're making decisions that are based, I don't want to say exactly on hunches, but you don't have, quite a foundation that some of us were hoping for. I mean, it's not like locked in.
Yeah, and I think that phenomenon is even more pronounced in psychiatry, where we're dealing with an organ that is very much very poorly understood as compared to something more. I'll say this with wondering if my brother and my father, the cardiologists, will listen to this and find it insulting. But I'll say as basic as the heart, which is a pump with four chambers in it. The brain is so complex that even in the year 2021, we're just starting to unlock its secrets. It's true. What you're getting at is 100% right, that a lot of what you do in clinical practice is, okay, this is my personal anecdotal experience with treating patients. This is what I've read in the textbooks and the literature and the science that comes out every week. The field evolves all the time. And this is what I've learned from my mentors about how to treat these conditions. And then you do your best by trying things out and seeing if they work. And if they work, then you're done. Terrific. And if they don't work, then you adjust your approach. And you're doing that ideally in almost every case, in most cases, with the partnership with the patient, right? The way I really look at it is you're sitting right alongside the patient, looking at the problem together and saying, all right, here are the tools I've got. I've got these medications that might help. I've got these interventions like electroconvulsive therapy, or in my case, at work, I do something called transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS for short. I've got these tools. There's also psychotherapy, talk therapy, all kinds of different techniques that might be helpful. Which of these might be the most helpful with the fewest, side effects or negative outcomes? And then you make that decision with the patient.
I'm guessing that in psychiatry, there's maybe a little bit more space available for the relational component, the patient-doctor relationship. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're right on. I sometimes think, in some fields, I'm sure, in things like radiology or pathology. Even if you break a bone and have to go to an orthopedic surgeon, they can probably do their jobs quite well without ever really getting to know you as a person. But in psychiatry, even if you see a psychiatrist who's primarily seeing people for medication management, you know, they're prescribing medications and brief visits, even if that's the case, they'll do their job better if they know you and what's important to you than if they don't. And so I think that you're absolutely right. There's room for that. There's more room for that. And I would say it's even a necessity in psychiatry to have that drive to get to know your patients and again, know what they care about so that you can also care about those things.
Now, that's important to me because I've been a patient many times and for all kinds of things, you know. I've got quite a history. And when I think about the conversations I've had with doctors, it's like I want to invite them in, but I sometimes wonder if they feel like there are, understandable boundaries where they're, not going to go too far into, at some point, the time's up and they got to move on to the next patient and they can't become best buddies, So how do you negotiate that? How do you navigate that, I guess?
Yeah, that's a great question because you're right. You want to connect at a person-to-person level. And then it's all happening within this system that I wouldn't say we've developed it intentionally. I would say it's developed out of entropy. The chaos of sort of the universe has led to this healthcare system that provides some of the best care in the world at its peak and also lets a lot of people through the cracks, fall through the cracks at its bottom. And so in other words, when you are seeing your doctor, depending on how you're seeing them and where you're seeing them and what setting, there's time pressure, there's logistical pressure, there's insurances, environmental factors in terms of, in what setting you're seeing them. All of those things do govern the interaction, right? And so sometimes we can put up artificial barriers. I can think of a later chapter in the book where I talk about seeing a patient in my what was supposed to be a psychopharm clinic, a clinic with brief appointments and where we're focused on medications to help reduce symptoms. But patients don't read the clinical guidelines about what the clinic is supposed to be. Of course, that's ridiculous. So for me to have that expectation was ridiculous. So when this patient really wanted to use that time differently. They wanted to use it because they trusted me at the time and they wanted to talk to me about what was going on in their life. And I, as a trainee, was taken aback. I wasn't sure what to do. And it wasn't until I spoke to one of my mentors who said, look, you're a doctor, they're a patient, they're connecting with you, you're serving an important role, even if it doesn't fit in with this model that the clinic has set up. And so I think that's an important lesson that a lot of doctors should take to heart in terms of meeting the patient where they are, even if it doesn't quite fit with what's sort of prescribed by the system.
I want to have you tell us the story about the woman with the mirrors. And the reason my background's in poetry, so when I think about human existence and mirrors, all of a sudden I start thinking poetry and I start thinking about the metaphor of it all. But I'm not so interested in – was her name Ginger? Ginger, I'm not so interested in her case per se, but I'm wondering how that changed you as you were developing and just training as a resident.
Yeah, so just to give a very brief background on this particular case, but then more broadly, as you say, this was a patient with paranoid schizophrenia and basically projected some of the psychotic thoughts that she was having onto this idea that images and mirrors were flipped, were not quite right. And in fact, I learned in my early training that a lot of psychosis can present in a similar way with images being or mirrors reflections being off. And I had a very brief moment of triumph early in the book where I thought of an intervention where if you basically have two mirrors, one in front and one in back, as they might in a barber shop to show you the back of your head, you can actually flip an image back to how it looks in the real world as opposed to the mirror image. And so I was very proud of myself. I thought I'd done quite well. And then soon after, this patient, you know, returned to the emergency department, of course, because she had a very chronic condition, a very serious mental illness that a very easy solution was not going to solve. And one of the lessons I took away from that was the humility that I had tried to take with me from those early training days all the way to now, that we can do things that are helpful, but we shouldn't overestimate our ability to cure, to take away problems entirely, that sometimes serious mental illness is very powerful and that we don't fully understand it. And so let me just bring it back to you and ask, was there more to that question that I didn't get to as I got derailed a little bit?
I find it fascinating that there was this aha moment for you where you thought, oh, I can intervene in this way with an extra mirror and it'll flip the image back around and maybe that will be reassuring or calming for this patient. And at least in the moment, that was certainly a triumph. And the humility thing, the fact that, you know, I guess in the penal system, they talk about recidivism. You don't talk about recidivistic patients. What do you say when a patient comes back after having been discharged?
Recurrent, you know, it's like a recurrent.
Yeah. And that's got to be disheartening too. And I guess what I want to know from you is how hard is it to feel like some situations are going to feel futile, that for all of your best efforts, it might feel like you're just postponing, you know, inevitable collapse and a life that just doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, that's a great question because it is something that I think about a lot, that I've given a lot of thought to. It comes across several different ways in the book that sometimes you can do everything right and negative outcomes happen. And so it's almost like an unfair question sometimes if you ask yourself, well, what should I have done differently? Because, you know, the path that we're all on usually always leads to death eventually, right? And so actually, I mentioned very briefly earlier that my father is a physician, he's a cardiologist. He was telling me the other day that he's been practicing on July 1st. It was the 40th anniversary of his practice. And kind of like a jerk, for no reason, I said to him, oh my goodness, can you imagine how many of your patients that you've treated over 40 years are no longer with us, you know, have passed away? And he's a cardiologist, so he treats a lot of older patients, and of course, a lot of them have passed away. But he said, you know what, actually, I think more about is there are some that are still with me from the very beginning. To think of how much good he's done for not only those patients that are still with him, but a lot of the patients who passed away, you know, that still where he was still able to help them over time. That conversation, it stuck with me because that's an attitude that wouldn't necessarily come naturally to me. But I think that over the course of my training and again, from his perspective, over the course of 40 years, you gain an appreciation for, again, the humility that you have to carry with you. We are trying to alleviate suffering. We're trying to prolong life, quality of life. But we are not, you know, there's this God complex among a lot of physicians, and it's not good. You have to have humility in the face of illness and mortality. And that's something that I've tried to cultivate in myself as well.
Last of all, the question I just put to you kind of ties in with the question of burnout. And here you've written a memoir about the front end of a career, and we're living in times with COVID where there are people who are looking for an exit sign to get out of the caring professions. We read on almost daily basis of practitioners, nurses, doctors who have – they're burnt out. And what do you have to say about – not necessarily about COVID, but just the profession? Even if we didn't have COVID, what do you say that somehow – keeps people going, that could give people the fuel for their tanks to keep going?
Yeah, I think that the one of the biggest factors that causes burnout and moral injury, this feeling like you're doing what you're supposed to, but it doesn't feel like it's supposed to feel in your head or your heart. And that's happening, as you say, across the board in medicine. I think some of the biggest factors involve feeling like a cog in a big machine, right? Losing the patient-doctor relationship that was what drew almost the vast majority of patients, of doctors that go into medicine want to help people. That's like the cliche answer during the interview is, why did you go into medicine? Oh, I wanted to help people, and I have this skill set, and I can do it and make a comfortable living while doing it. That's wonderful. I should do that. That's basically what draws people in, is they want to do good in the world. They think they can, you know, devote themselves to the career. And often as years go by, sometimes people can become disillusioned. So I won't harp on COVID, but, you know, one of the challenges in COVID is that, you know, it wasn't during necessarily the very early days when the alarms were blaring in New York City that, you know, where at every night at 7 p.m. there were applause for the healthcare providers in the city. And it wasn't that so much as the months went on and you realized that there were, you know, healthcare workers were to some extent, many more than myself as a psychiatrist, putting their lives and their families' well-being on the line, really, really giving to the profession, and seeing things not, you know, seeing the sort of divide that's occurred within the nation around how to react, how to live our lives. It's been a very challenging thing for a lot of people, and so on the one hand, I feel concerned that there are so many people thinking about leaving the profession. At the other end, I have read that applications to medical schools are way up, and I think that part of that is because there's also been a spotlight put on healthcare providers, professionals, that how vital they are to the society. And I think that the future will be bright as long as we're able to attend to maintaining the doctor-patient relationship, maintaining the therapeutic alliance in every realm, every corner of the medical center. If we can do that, then the future is bright.
Such a pleasure to visit with you, Adam. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Psychiatrist Adam Stern with us. His new memoir is titled Committed: Dispatches from a Psychiatrist in Training. Nowadays, we hear story after story of medical professionals, very dedicated, who enter into their careers with idealism and then get ground down by it all. This profession is not for the faint of heart. Doesn't matter if you're in psychiatry or heart surgery, and this has nothing to do with fainting at the sight of blood. Coming up next here on the show, the life of a top-flight lung transplant surgeon. He's going to tell his story, how he found himself dispirited by the very thing he loved and what he did about it. Stay tuned. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We're talking this hour with two medical professionals about the rewards and the challenges of a life spent saving and sometimes losing patients. We're going to turn now to a transplant surgeon. His career was full of miracle and wonder, but also tragedy, which led him to ask, what happens when the hero doesn't want to be a hero anymore? David Weil, author of Exhale, Hope, Healing, and Life in Transplant. I want you to hear part of my conversation with him. We're talking about the trauma he experienced over time and how that eventually led him to set down his scalpel.
I tended, for better or for worse, to err on the side of being optimistic and being positive and trying to give patients hope. I know that at times in doing so, I wasn't being 100% transparent, and I regret that. I truly do. But at the same time, I think it's the best way. It was the best way that I knew how to take care of the patient right in front of me, was to allow them to maintain that hope. I think some could argue with that, if it actually does more harm to patients than good. But that was the way I approached it, at least.
Now, you have been very honest in sharing your own story and basically letting the world see that this took a toll on you. This whole issue that doctors are there to help us and are going to help us. That, you know, I'm just wondering how beneficial it is to all of us to hear that you had to kind of step back from this because it was too hard. I mean, does that help you the profession? Does it help your fellow doctors? Does it help patients?
My view is that it helps all of the stakeholders that you mentioned. I think it's important for patients to realize that they're not, even though it may appear like they are not dealing with a robot, that there is a person behind those short clinic visits and those brief hospital visits and those three or four sentences and out the door. There's a person, and that person sometimes has a bad day and sometimes bad month. They've got a sick kid at home. They got cut off in traffic on the way to work. They had a fight with their spouse. They're human beings. And I think it's important for patients to understand that. And then the other part of writing the book and the response I've gotten since the book has been published is from hundreds of healthcare workers who are telling me, thank you. Thank you for saying what's on our mind. You had the guts, frankly, to say that we should be considered and treated like human beings. We are suffering, particularly during the pandemic years, but generally, even before that. And so I think other doctors are gratified that if they couldn't or wouldn't say it, or just didn't want to, that somebody said it. I think that's a positive development, and I think that's one positive from the book.
It's kind of a cliche that behind the scenes, doctors will take each other's temperature, like, how are you doing, or how are you coping with this, or I know this is hard for you. But what about patients? Have you ever had a patient say, Dr. Weil, I don't think you're doing so well?
Well, and I write about this in the book, and this was also concerning to me. At the very end of my period at Stanford, I was obviously struggling. I don't think that it was much of a secret. And when patients, and one family in particular that I write about toward the end of the book, somebody I call Allie in the book was the patient's name. When families lose a loved one and they see me react to it emotionally, and their first instinct is to try to comfort me after they've lost a loved one, that seems a little backwards to me, but at the same time, that was the situation I found myself in. So to answer your question, yes, I think some of the patients picked up on the fact that this was causing me a lot of emotional hurt. And I must say that I wasn't very happy about that. That made me kind of feel worse in a way, because it then became, their loss became about me and not about their own loss. And that concerned me a little bit.
But after now some time has elapsed from that, can't you make room for a narrative where they were offering the very same kind of compassion that you as a professional have tried to offer? And that's a good thing.
I think it is a good thing. And actually, what I remember most about those situations is the grace that these folks showed me. And I think it's amazing. But at some level, I figured that it was my job to take on that kind of emotional hurt, not their job. And even though that may seem not rational, that's how I looked at it. Now, in retrospect, I look at it as that these are incredibly fine human beings that were trying to help out somebody that was trying to help them. And that's the kind of grace that I look back on, and I'm still in awe of, frankly. It seems amazing to me.
And from a logical perspective, can you see that all of your training in your specialization wasn't necessarily about emotional care, and that they may have been just as qualified as you ever were to provide emotional support?
Yes. And in many cases, they were much more equipped to provide that kind of support than I was, quite frankly. This was in no way part of my medical training, and frankly, not part of my background really either. I played sports as a kid. I had, you know, sort of type A, very driven, mostly male medical mentors. And the reaction to most problems was to tough it up and suck it up. And that was the way I was brought up, both as, you know, a younger man and also as a medical doctor, that we were really programmed to go forward, not to spend a lot of time thinking about how all of this was impacting us. Having said that, I think one silver lining of the COVID pandemic has been that all of us in healthcare are thinking more and more about the emotional well-being of the workforce. And I think that that's a very good development and long overdue.
The title of your book is Exhale. Would you parse that for us just a little bit? What kind of a metaphorical intent did you have there?
Well, I obviously, from being a respiratory doctor, I think a lot about inhaling and exhaling. And I think the inhaling part in our life, metaphorically, is easy. Being able to build and grow and amp up, which I think is seen when we take a deep breath, that's us getting ready for life, is easier than it is to do the opposite, which is to exhale, which is to take things more slowly, which is to be more introspective, which is to meditate, which is to ponder. And I think exhaling actually activates the parasympathetic system in our body, which helps us calm down. And I think that was mainly the reason I wanted to title the book Exhale, because I think it's all about the introspection that many of us need to do at certain junctures of our life, and one that I reached in the book 5 years ago.
David Weil, he's author of Exhale, Hope, Healing, and a Life in Transplant. In our next hour, we're going to go for some lighter fare, lighter in mood, I should say, not lighter in calories, not if there's lard in your refried beans or tamales. There's quite a history behind the way Mexican food conquered America. If you don't believe that has happened, you haven't compared salsa sales with ketchup. The author of Taco USA, next on Constant Wonder.